along a continuum that runs from aggressive to defensive. When we're getting value cheap, we should be aggressive. When we're getting value expensive, we should pull back. Calibrating one's portfolio position is what this book is mostly about. In the world investors inhabit, cycles rise and fall, and pendulums swing back and forth. Cycles and pendulum swings come in many forms and relate to a wide variety of phenomena. But the underlying reasons for them and the patterns they produce have a lot in common, and they tend to be somewhat consistent over time. Or, as Mark Twain is reputed to have said, although there's no evidence he actually said it, history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. Whether Twain said it or not, that sentence sums up a lot of what this book is about. Cycles vary in terms of reasons and details, and timing and extent, but the ups and downs, and the reasons for them, will occur forever, producing changes in the investment environment, and thus in the behavior that's called for. The fact is that the performance of these things is heavily influenced in the short run by, among other things, the involvement of people, and people are far from steady. Rather, they fluctuate from time to time, often because of things we can lump under the broad heading of psychology. Thus, people's behavior varies, certainly as the environment varies, but sometimes in the absence of changes in the environment, too. The cycle oscillates around the midpoint. The midpoint of a cycle is generally thought of as the secular trend, norm, mean, average, or happy medium, and generally as being in some sense as right and proper. The extremes of the cycle, on the other hand, are thought of as aberrations or excesses to be returned from, and generally they are. While the thing that's cycling tends to spend much of the time above or below it, eventual movement back in the direction of the midpoint is usually the rule. The movement from either a high or a low extreme back toward the midpoint is often described as regression toward the mean, a powerful and very reasonable tendency in most walks of life. But it can also be seen that the cyclical pattern generally consists as much of movement from the reasonable midpoint toward a potentially imprudent extreme as it does going from an extreme back toward the midpoint. The rational midpoint generally exerts a kind of magnetic pull, bringing the thing that's cycling back from an extreme in the direction of normal. But it usually doesn't stay at normal for long, as the influences responsible for the swing toward the midpoint invariably continue in force, and thus cause the swing back from an extreme to proceed through the midpoint and then carry further toward the opposite extreme. It's important to recognize and accept the dependability of this pattern. The details vary, but the underlying dynamics are usually similar. The themes that provide warning signals in every boom bust are the general ones, that excessive optimism is a dangerous thing, that risk aversion is an essential ingredient for the market to be safe, and that overly generous capital markets ultimately lead to unwise financing, and thus, to danger for participants. In short, the details are unimportant and can be irrelevant, but the themes are essential, and they absolutely do tend to recur. Understanding that tendency and being able to spot the recurrences is one of the most important elements in dealing with cycles. Cycles have more potential to wreak havoc the further they progress from the midpoint. That is, the greater the aberrations or excesses. If the swing toward one extreme goes further, the swing back is likely to be more violent, and more damage is likely to be done, as actions encouraged by the cycle's operation at an extreme prove unsuitable for life elsewhere in the cycle. In other words, the potential for havoc increases as the movement away from the midpoint increases. As economies and companies do too well, and stock prices go too high, advances are followed by mere corrections, and bull markets by bear markets. But booms and bubbles are followed by much more harmful busts, crashes, and panics. Most people think of cycles as series of events that follow each other in a usual sequence. Upswings are followed by downswings, and then eventually by new upswings. But to have a full understanding of cycles, that's not enough. The events in the life of a cycle shouldn't be viewed merely as each being followed by the next, but, much more importantly, as each causing the next. The things I call cycles do not stem completely, or sometimes at all, from the operation of mechanical, scientific, or physical processes. They would be much more dependable and predictable if they did, but much less potentially profitable. This is because the greatest profits come from seeing things better than others do, and if cycles were totally dependable and predictable, there would be no such thing as superiority in seeing them. Sometimes there is an underlying principle, and sometimes not, but much variation is attributable to the role of humans in creating cycles. The involvement of humans in this process enables their emotion and psychology-induced tendencies to influence cyclical phenomena. Chance, or randomness, also plays a big part in some cycles, and human behavior contributes to their existence, too. Humans are a big part of the reason these cycles exist, but also, along with randomness, for their inconsistency, and thus, their undependability. The effort to explain life through the recognition of patterns, and thus to come up with winning formulas, is complicated, in large part because we live in a world that is beset by randomness, and in which people don't behave the same from one instance to the next, even when they intend to. The realization that past events were largely affected by these things, and thus that future events aren't fully predictable, is unpleasant, as it makes life less subject to anticipation, rulemaking, and rendering safe. Thus, people search for explanations that would make events understandable, often to an extent beyond that which is appropriate. This is as true in investing as it is in other aspects of life. Why is the pendulum of psychology important? In essence, the two strong upward and downward swings of the cycles I'm covering in this book largely result from, and represent, psychological excesses in action. In business, financial and market cycles, most excesses on the upside and the inevitable reactions to the downside, which also tend to overshoot, are the result of exaggerated swings of the pendulum of psychology. Thus, understanding and being alert to excessive swings is an entry-level requirement for avoiding harm from cyclical extremes, and hopefully, for profiting from them. The norms in terms of growth and appreciation are in some sense right and healthy. And if the participants built their behavior around those norms, instead of occasionally building up hopes for more and thus setting the stage for eventual moves toward less, the world would be a steadier, less tempestuous, and less error-prone place. But that's not the nature of things. It all seems so obvious. Investors rarely maintain objective, rational, neutral, and stable positions. First, they exhibit high levels of optimism, greed, risk tolerance, and credulousness, and their resulting behavior causes asset prices to rise, potential returns to fall, and risk to increase. But then, for some reason, perhaps the arrival of a tipping point, they switch to pessimism, fear, risk aversion, and skepticism. And this causes asset prices to fall, prospective returns to rise, and risk to decrease. Notably, each group of phenomena tends to happen in unison, and the swing from one to the other often goes far beyond what reason might call for. That's one of the crazy things. In the real world, things generally fluctuate between pretty good and not so hot. But in the world of investing, perception often swings from flawless to hopeless. The pendulum careens from one extreme to the other, spending almost no time at the happy medium, and rather little in the range of reasonableness. First there's denial, and then there's capitulation. At the greatest extremes of the pendulum's swing, a process can take on the appearance of a virtuous circle or a vicious circle. When events are predominantly positive, and psychology is rosy, negative developments tend to be overlooked. Everything is interpreted favorably, and things are often thought to be incapable of taking a turn for the worse. On the other hand, when things have been going badly for months or years, and psychology is highly negative, it's the potential for improvement that can be forgotten. The superior investor, who resists external influences, remains emotionally balanced, and acts rationally, perceives both positive and negative events, weighs events objectively, and analyzes them dispassionately. But the truth is that sometimes euphoria and optimism cause most investors to view things more positively than is warranted, and sometimes depression and pessimism make them see only bad and interpret events with a negative cast. Refusing to do so is one of the keys to successful investing. Usually, when either set of polar extremes is in the ascendancy, that fact is readily observable, and thus the implications for investors should be obvious to objective observers. But of course, the swing of the market pendulum to one extreme or the other occurs for the simple reason that the psyches of most market participants are moving in the same direction in a herd-like fashion. My view that risk is the main moving piece in investing makes me conclude that at any given point in time, the way investors collectively are viewing risk and behaving with regard to it is of overwhelming importance in shaping the investment environment in which we find ourselves. And the state of the environment is key in determining how we should behave with regard to risk at that point. Assessing where attitudes toward risk stand in their cycle is perhaps the most important topic covered in this book. Good times cause people to become more optimistic, jettison their caution, and settle for skimpy risk premiums on risky investments. Further, since they are less pessimistic and less alarmed, they tend to lose interest in the safer end of the risk-return continuum. This combination of elements makes the prices of risky assets rise relative to safer assets. Thus, it shouldn't come as a surprise that more unwise investments are made in good times than in bad. People are more inclined to make risky investments in good times, even though the higher prices often mean the prospective risk premiums offered are skimpier than they were in more risk-conscious times. And when negative events occur, the lack of adequate risk premiums and margin for error shows the investments to have been unwise. It follows from the above that risk is high when investors feel risk is low. And risk compensation is at a minimum just when risk is at a maximum, meaning risk compensation is most needed. So much for the rational investor. For me, the bottom line of all of this is that the greatest source of investment risk is the belief that there is no risk. Widespread risk tolerance, or a high degree of investor comfort with risk, is the greatest harbinger of subsequent market declines. But this is rarely perceived at the time when perceiving it. And turning cautious is most important. Just as the inadequacy of investors' risk aversion allows them to push prices up and buy at the top, egged on by the vision of easy money in a world in which they can't discern any risk, in less positive times, they push prices down and sell at the bottom. Their unpleasant experience convinces them, contrary to what they had thought when everything was going well, that investing is a risky field in which they shouldn't engage. And as a consequence, their risk aversion goes all the way from inadequate to excessive. They become worry warts. Just as risk tolerance had positioned them to become buyers of overpriced assets at the highs, now their screaming risk aversion makes them sellers, certainly not buyers, at the bottom. During panics, people spend 100% of their time making sure there can be no losses, at just the time that they should be worrying instead about missing out on great opportunities. In times of extreme negativism, exaggerated risk aversion is likely to cause prices to already be as low as they can go, further losses to be highly unlikely, and thus the risk of loss to be minimal. Thus, the safest time to buy usually comes when everyone is convinced there's no hope. As risk attitudes swing from high to low, so do opportunities for profit or loss. When everything's going well and asset prices are soaring, investors tend to view the future as rosy, risk as their friend, and profit as easily achieved. Everyone feels the same, meaning little risk aversion is incorporated in asset prices, and thus they're precarious. Investors become risk tolerant just when they should increase their risk aversion. And when events are down, so are investors. They think of the markets as a place to lose money, risk as something to be avoided at all cost, and losses as depressingly likely. Under the excess of caution that prevails, A, no one will accept possibilities that incorporate any optimism at all, and B, they likewise cannot countenance the possibility that an assumption could be too bad to be true. Just as risk tolerance is unlimited at the top, it is non-existent at the bottom. This negativity causes prices to fall to levels from which losses are highly unlikely, and gains could be enormous. But the sting of prior declines tends to increase risk aversion and send investors to the sidelines, just as prices, and thus risk, are at their lowest. Understanding how investors are thinking about and dealing with risk is perhaps the most important thing to strive for. In short, excessive risk tolerance contributes to the creation of danger, and the swing to excessive risk aversion depresses markets, creating some of the greatest buying opportunities. The fluctuation, or inconstancy, in attitudes toward risk is both the result of some cycles and the cause or exacerbator of others. And it will always go on, since it seems to be hardwired into most people's psyches to become more optimistic and risk-tolerant when things are going well, and then more worried and risk-averse when things turn downward. That means they're most willing to buy when they should be most cautious, and most reluctant to buy when they should be most aggressive. Superior investors recognize this and strive to behave as contrarians. Changes in the availability of capital or credit constitute one of the most fundamental influences on economies, companies, and markets. Even though the credit cycle is less well known to the man on the street than most of the other cycles discussed in this book, I consider it to be of paramount importance and profound influence. When the credit window is open, financing is plentiful and easily obtained, and when it's closed, financing is scarce and hard to get. Finally, it's essential to always bear in mind that the window can go from wide open to slammed shut in just an instant. There's a lot more to fully understanding this cycle, including the reasons for these cyclical movements and their impact, but that's the bottom line. Prosperity brings expanded lending, which leads to unwise lending, which produces large losses, which makes lenders stop lending, which ends prosperity, and on and on. Looking for the cause of a market extreme usually requires rewinding the videotape of the credit cycle a few months or years. Most raging bull markets are abetted by an upsurge in the willingness to provide capital, usually imprudently. Likewise, most collapses are preceded by a wholesale refusal to finance certain companies, industries, or the entire gamut of would-be borrowers. The key to dealing with the credit cycle lies in recognizing that it reaches its apex when things have been going well for a while. News has been good, risk aversion is low, and investors are eager. That makes it easy for borrowers to raise money and causes buyers and investors to compete for the opportunity to provide it. The result is cheap financing, low credit standards, weak deals, and the unwise extension of credit. Borrowers hold the cards when the credit window is wide open, not lenders or investors. The implications of all of this should be obvious. Proceed with caution. The exact opposite becomes true at the other extreme of the credit cycle. Its nadir is reached when developments are unpleasant, risk aversion is heightened, and investors are depressed. Under such circumstances, no one wants to provide capital, the credit market freezes up, and proposed offerings go begging. This puts the cards into the hands of providers of capital rather than borrowers. Because borrowing is difficult and capital is generally unavailable, those who possess it and are willing to part with it can apply rigorous standards, insist on strong loan structures and protective covenants, and demand high prospective returns. It's things like these that provide the margin of safety required for superior investing. When these boxes can be ticked, investors should swing into an aggressive mode. Superior investing doesn't come from buying high-quality assets, but from buying when the deal is good, the price is low, the potential return is substantial, and the risk is limited. These conditions are much more the case when the credit markets are in the less euphoric, more stringent part of their cycle. The slammed-shut phase of the credit cycle probably does more to make bargains available than any other single factor. The merits of the asset in question matter only so much, and certainly they can't be strong enough to always carry the day. Human emotion inevitably causes the prices of assets, even worthwhile assets, to be transported to levels that are extreme and unsustainable, either vertiginous highs or overly pessimistic lows. In short, conscientious belief in the inevitability of cycles like I'm urging means that a number of words and phrases must be excluded from the intelligent investor's vocabulary. These include never, always, forever, can't, won't, will, and has to. About 45 years ago, in the early 1970s, I received one of the greatest gifts I was ever given, when an older and wiser investor introduced me to the three stages of a bull market. The first stage, when only a few unusually perceptive people believe things will get better. The second stage, when most investors realize that improvement is actually taking place. And the third stage, when everyone concludes things will get better forever. The arrival of this simple truth opened my eyes to the notion of investors' psychological extremes and the impact of those extremes on market cycles. Like many of the great quotations and adages, it captures disproportionate wisdom in a few simple words. It's all about the changeability of attitudes, the pattern they follow over the course of a cycle, and how they contribute to error. In the first stage, because the possibility of improvement is invisible to most investors, and thus unappreciated, security prices incorporate little or no optimism. Often the first stage occurs after prices have been pounded in a crash, and the same downtrend that decimated prices also has wiped out psychology, turning the members of the crowd against the market and causing them to swear off investing forever. In the last stage, on the other hand, events have gone well for so long and have been reflected so powerfully in asset prices, further lifting the mood of the market, that investors extrapolate improvement to infinity and bid up prices to reflect their optimism. Trees generally don't grow to the sky, but in this stage investors act as if they will and pay up for the limitless potential they perceive. Few things are as costly as paying for potential that turns out to have been overrated. It follows from the above that someone who invests in the first stage, when almost no one can see a reason for optimism, buys assets at bargain prices from which substantial appreciation is possible. But someone who buys in the third stage invariably pays a high price for the market's excessive enthusiasm and loses money as a result. The most important thing to note is that maximum psychology, maximum availability of credit, maximum price, minimum potential return, and maximum risk all are reached at the same time. And usually, these extremes coincide with the last paroxysm of buying. In the reverse of the top that results from the upswing of the market cycle, we see that the nadir of psychology, a total inability to access credit, minimum price, maximum potential return, and minimum risk all coincide at the bottom, when the last optimist throws in the towel. Since the generalizations at the lows of the financial crisis of 2007 to 2008 were on the downside, the error-making machine went into reverse. No greed, only fear. No optimism, only pessimism. No risk tolerance, only risk aversion. No ability to see positives, only negatives. No willingness to interpret things positively, only negatively. No ability to imagine good outcomes, only bad. What is a bottom? It's the point when the lowest prices of the cycle are reached. Thus, a bottom can be viewed as the day the last panicked holder sells, or the last day on which sellers predominate relative to buyers. From the bottom, prices rise, since there are no holders left to capitulate and sell, or because the buyers now want to buy more strongly than the sellers want to sell. When a market is cascading downward, investors can often be heard to say, "We're not going to try to catch a falling knife." In other words, the trend is downward, and there's no way to know when it'll stop. So why should we buy before we're sure the bottom has been reached? What I think they're really saying is, we're scared, in particular of buying before the decline has stopped, and thus of looking bad. So we're going to wait until the bottom has been reached, the dust has settled, and the uncertainty has been resolved. But hopefully, by now, I've made it abundantly clear that when the dust has settled and investors' nerves have steadied, the bargains will be gone. It's usually during market slides that you can buy the largest quantities of the thing you want from sellers who are throwing in the towel, and while the non-knife catchers are hugging the sidelines. Once the slide has culminated in a bottom, by definition there are few sellers left to sell, and during the ensuing rally, it's buyers who predominate. Thus, the selling dries up, and would-be buyers face growing competition. Exiting the market after a decline, and thus failing to participate in a cyclical rebound, is truly the cardinal sin in investing. Experiencing a mark-to-market loss in the downward phase of a cycle isn't fatal in and of itself, as long as you hold through the beneficial upward part as well. It's converting that downward fluctuation into a permanent loss by selling out at the bottom that's really terrible. Thus, understanding cycles and having the emotional and financial wherewithal needed to live through them is an essential ingredient in investment success. If the market were a disciplined calculator of value based exclusively on company fundamentals, the price of a security wouldn't fluctuate much more than the issuer's current earnings and the outlook for earnings in the future. In fact, the price generally should fluctuate less than earnings, since quarter-to-quarter changes in earnings often even out in the long run. And besides, don't necessarily reflect actual changes in the company's long-term potential. And yet, security prices generally fluctuate much more than earnings. The reasons, of course, are largely psychological, emotional, and non-fundamental. Thus, price changes exaggerate and overstate fundamental changes. The truth is that financial facts and figures are only a starting point for market behavior. Investor rationality is the exception, not the rule. And the market spends little of its time calmly weighing financial data and setting prices free of emotionality. The investor's goal is to position capital so as to benefit from future developments. He wants to have more invested when the market rises than when it falls, and to own more of the things that rise more or fall less, and less of the others. The objective is clear. The question is, how to accomplish this? In the absence of the ability to see the future, how can we position our portfolios for what lies ahead? I think much of the answer lies in understanding where the market stands in its cycle and what that implies for its future movements. As I wrote in The Most Important Thing, we may never know where we're going, but we'd better have a good idea where we are. What's the key in all of this? To know where the pendulum of psychology and the cycle in valuation stand in their swings. To refuse to buy, and perhaps to sell, when too positive psychology and the willingness to assign too high valuations cause prices to soar to peak levels. And to buy when downcast psychology and the desertion of valuation standards on the downside cause panicky investors to create bargains by selling despite the low prices that prevail. As Sir John Templeton put it, to buy when others are despondently selling, and sell when others are greedily buying, requires the greatest fortitude and pays the greatest reward. The essential ingredient here is inference, one of my favorite words. Everyone sees what happens each day, as reported in the media. But how many people make an effort to understand what those everyday events say about the psyches of market participants, the investment climate, and thus what should be done in response? Simply put, we must strive to understand the implications of what's going on around us. When others are recklessly confident and buying aggressively, we should be highly cautious. When others are frightened into inaction or panicked selling, we should become aggressive. Psychological and emotional elements have their primary impact by convincing investors that past valuation standards have become irrelevant and can be departed from. When investors are flying high and making money, they find it easy to come up with convenient reasons why assets should be untethered from the constraints of valuation norms. The explanation usually begins with, "It's different this time." Watch out for this ominous sign of the willing suspension of disbelief. Likewise, when asset prices collapse in a crash, it's usually because of an assumption that none of the things that supported value in the past can be trusted to work in the future. "It's different this time" are four of the most dangerous words in the business world, especially when applied, as is often the case, to something that has reached what in prior times would have been called an extreme. When people say "it's different," in this case, what they mean is that the rules and processes that produced cycles in the past have been suspended. But the cyclical behavior of the financial past did not result from the operation of physical or scientific rules. In science, cause and effect enjoy a dependable and repeatable relationship, so that it's possible to say with confidence if A, then B. But while there are some principles that operate in the world of finance and business, the resulting truth is very different from that in science. The reason for this, as I've harped on repeatedly, is the involvement of people. People's decisions have great influence on economic, business, and market cycles. In fact, economies, business, and markets consist of nothing but transactions between people. And people don't make their decisions scientifically. People have feelings, and as such, they aren't bound by inviolable laws. They'll always bring emotions and foibles to their economic and investing decisions. As a result, they'll become euphoric at the wrong time and despondent at the wrong time, exaggerating the upside potential when things are going well and the downside risk when things are going poorly. And thus, they'll take trends to cyclical extremes. Cycle positioning is the process of deciding on the risk posture of your portfolio in response to your judgments regarding the principal cycles, and asset selection is the process of deciding which markets, market niches, and specific securities or assets to overweight and underweight. These are the two main tools in portfolio management. It may be an oversimplification, but I think everything investors do falls under one or the other of these headings. Cycle positioning primarily consists of choosing between aggressiveness and defensiveness, increasing and decreasing exposure to market movements. The recipe for success here consists of A, thoughtful analysis of where the market stands in its cycle, B, a resulting increase in aggressiveness or defensiveness, and C, being proved right. These things can be summed up as skill or alpha at cycle positioning. Of course, C, being proved right, isn't a matter fully within anyone's control, in particular because of the degree to which it is subject to randomness. So being proved right won't happen every time, even to skillful investors who reason things out well. When the market is low in its cycle, gains are more likely than usual, and losses are less likely. The reverse is true when the market is high in its cycle. Positioning moves, based on where you believe the market stands in its cycle, amount to trying to better prepare your portfolio for the events that lie ahead. While you can always be unlucky regarding the relationship between what logically should happen and what actually does happen, good positioning decisions can increase the chance that the market's tendency, and thus the chance for outperformance, will be on your side. In my opinion, it's entirely reasonable to try to improve long-term investment results by altering positions on the basis of an understanding of the market cycle. But it's essential that you also understand the limitations, as well as the skills that are required, and how difficult it is. Importantly, I want to call attention to the obvious fact that, rather than the everyday ups and downs of the market, the clear examples provided in this book all concern once-in-a-lifetime cyclical extremes, which these days seem to happen about once a decade. First, the extremes of bubble and crash, and in particular the process through which they arise, most clearly illustrate the cycle in action and how to respond to it. And second, it's when dealing with pronounced extremes that we should expect the highest likelihood of success. Between the extremes of rich and cheap, when the cycle is in the middle ground of fair, the state of the relationship between price and value is, by definition, nowhere as clear-cut as at the extremes. As a result, it's hard to make frequent distinctions, and hard to do so correctly. Thus, distinctions in the middle ground aren't as potentially profitable as at the extremes, and those distinctions can't be expected to work out as dependably. Detecting and exploiting the extremes is really the best we can hope for, and I believe it can be done dependably if you're analytical, insightful, experienced, or well-versed in history, and unemotional. That means, however, that you shouldn't expect to reach profitable conclusions daily, monthly, or even yearly. The reasonableness of the effort at cycle timing depends simply on what you expect of it. If you frequently try to discern where we are in the cycle, in the sense of what's going to happen tomorrow or what's in store for us next month, you're unlikely to find success. I describe such an effort as trying to be cute. No one can make fine distinctions like those often enough or consistently right enough to add materially to investment results. And no one knows when the market developments that efforts at cycle positioning label probable will materialize. As Peter Bernstein said, the future is not ours to know, but it helps to know that being wrong is inevitable and normal, not some terrible tragedy, not some awful failing in reasoning, not even bad luck in most instances. Being wrong comes with the franchise of an activity whose outcome depends on an unknown future. The tendency of people to go to excess will never end. And thus, since those excesses eventually have to correct, neither will the occurrence of cycles. Economies and markets have never moved in a straight line in the past, and neither will they do so in the future. And that means investors with the ability to understand cycles will find opportunities for profit.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Mastering the Market Cycle, Getting the Odds on Your Side. Written by Howard Marks. Performed by L.J. Ganser. Introduction performed by Howard Marks. Executive producers Rena Ayer and Mike Charzik. Producer Chris Sacco. Copyright 2018 by Howard Marks. Sound recording copyright 2018 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.